is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
If I had to start a team, I would take LeBron over Jordan. If I have to have a last shot in a clutch moment, I would take Jordan.
Joe Cowley is the Chicago Bulls beat writer for the Chicago Sun-Times. A graduate of Kent State University, Cowley was one of the regular beat writers covering the White Sox during their 2005 World Series championship. After covering the White Sox for many years, Cowley has been the beat writer for the Chicago Bulls for the past several seasons. If you're enjoying the Hoopheads podcast, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and review on your favorite podcast app. You can get all the show notes and other information about this episode at our brand new website, www.hoopheadspod.com. Listen in as Jason and I talk NBA with the Chicago Sun-Times' Joe Cowley. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome my longtime friend from the Chicago Sun-Times, Joe Cowley. Joe, welcome.
Boys, how you guys doing?
We are great, man. We are great. We are glad to have
you
on.
And we're especially great since the Bulls decided to win last night.
Probably the worst thing they could be doing right now, actually.
Listen, that's what we talk about all the time.
We talk about every time we talk NBA, and Jason will send me a text, and we'll get the Cavs updates, and they'll win, and I'll be like, that is just a catastrophic win. What are they doing?
That's the huge debate right now that a lot of these organizations in that bottom area are having, especially with the new draft rules and the percentages flattening out like they have for this upcoming season. I mean, that's the great debate. Are you developing guys, and is winning part of that development at the expense of adding a bigger talent or adding the ultimate prize, which is Zion Williamson? I mean, this draft's kind of a crazy draft because it's not deep. It's real top heavy. And you might get a guy who is a once in a generation if you feel that way about Zion. And I do. So that's the big debate that the media and the Bulls and even inside the Bulls department, they are debating that on a game to game basis. So it's kind of crazy. I mean, that's the state of the NBA right now.
Absolutely. All right. So let's start with Zion, because I've been stumping for him since I saw him play on the Duke Canada basketball tour back in the preseason. I've been on the bandwagon of whatever team you are, and obviously we're Cavs fans. You got to get Zion. I just think that physically, the tools and the things that he has are just unprecedented in the game of basketball. And then as the season has gone on, I think he's demonstrated that not only does he have tremendous physical tools, but I think he's been a revelation in terms of how skilled he's been with the ball, being able to handle it, being able to pass it. And, I think the one weakness in his game at this point, probably most people would point to, his outside shot. But what's your take on Zion as an NBA prospect?
I think his weakness is his shoe.
Yeah, maybe his shoe.
When people ask me about him, I say, I've seen a guy, Melvin Levitt out of Cleveland, who went and played for Cincinnati, who to me was one of the greatest leapers in the college game. And I covered him in high school back in Villa Angela, St. Joe. And I went to Vegas with that all-star team of him and James Posey and Damon Stringer and Doc Taylor. I mean, a lot of good players that were coming out of Cleveland at that time. And I had never seen anyone just have that kind of vertical leap until I saw Zion. Well, the difference is now you put that in a Larry Johnson type body with a Sean Kemp type explosiveness around the rim, and you have something that the college game has never seen in one package. You can't say, well, this guy reminds me of Zion, or this guy reminds me of Zion, because he is something that is so unique. Now, look, we may all be wrong. That 285-pound frame may give out at the pro game. And then what is he if he does get hurt? I mean, we're seeing a knee injury right now, but what if it's something significant and that athleticism is stripped away, which I got to see firsthand of what became of Derrick Rose once that athleticism was stripped away and you had to reinvent the game, and he just didn't have the IQ to figure that out. There's always that danger. But as far as when I look at what he is, as far as a pro prospect and comps that people try to put him in, you can't do that. And to me, that is something unique. That is something different. He's going to be an instant draw no matter where he goes. He's must-see TV no matter where he goes. And then there's, you know, we have Wendell Carter Jr. here with the Bulls, who was at Duke last year and has a lot of buddies still there and knows Zion. And the thing that strikes me the most that people probably don't always get to see are the intangibles on and off the court. I mean, just a likable guy, a coachable guy, loves the game, no attitude, selfless player. I mean, everything you would dream of, with that package of athleticism. So to me, he might be a once in a generational type guy for an organization. You hear the comparisons, Scottie Pippen throws names out there and has given high, I think he said he's the best prospect since Michael Jordan. I mean, that's a big,
he's gonna, if he gets there,
he's better than LeBron.
If he gets there, yeah. That's pretty good. That's a pretty good ceiling.
So yeah, I think that this guy is something special, and if he falls short of that, I will be shocked. I just have that much, and like I said, because of the intangibles and because of the other things, and then you hear some people here in Chicago, well, if they get the number one pick and they get lucky and they jump and do get that number one pick, well, you know, where is he going to play? They've already got Lowry Markin, and they traded for Otto Porter. You know what? He plays wherever he damn wants to.
That's right. Yeah, I think you figure that out without much problem.
Figure that out. Exactly. You figure that out.
Do you think he plays in the tournament or no?
I think he will, unless maybe there's a tweak or there's some kind of setback with it. I just think he loves the game, and I think he loves Duke. He loves his teammates. That's one of the things that Wendell told us all at the beginning of the year when the Duke show started, is he was talking to those guys just about the incoming freshmen and that just how well they all get along. And the guys that have been there for a couple of years were saying it's the closest Duke team that the coaches can remember seeing as far as all getting along. You know, that Duke team last year, everyone talks about, the talent that came out of it. You know, obviously Marvin Bagley and Wendell Carter and Grayson Allen. I don't get the feel when you talk to Wendell that they actually loved each other, because a couple of them were doing things that put it this way. No one knew what Wendell Carter really was until you got him in the private workouts, because he sacrificed so much for Marvin Bagley and was asked to do so much for Marvin Bagley. He gave up a lot of offense. And that's one thing when you're evaluating the college game these days, because the game is so overcoached. And because the system could be so overwhelming to a guy, or as far as putting him in a box and taking him out of his comfort zone, lots of times you really don't know what these guys are as far as a pro prospect till you get your hands on him and you get him in that camp or that private pro workout, or you get him in the Chicago draft camp and you start measuring the intangibles and actually see them compete with some freedom. So I think that was the big thing that surprised us about Carter, is how athletic he was, because all we knew was that Duke team started off man-to-man and had to switch to zone. So someone was at fault.
Right.
And then you start looking around and saying, all right, who is guarding the spot? Exactly.
Yep, right.
And so, that's one thing that people have to be careful about when they're evaluating that college to pro jump, is what are you watching exactly on those Saturdays and Monday nights on ESPN?
I mean, yeah, the game's so different. It's so different, especially I think the difference is even bigger now because of just the volume of threes that are being shot in the NBA and the spacing on the floor. If we go back to Zion, you put him in an NBA game where the floor is more spread and he's not, facing a 2-3 zone where he's got to go through 2-3-4 right. defenders in order to score. And now suddenly, okay, who's guarding him? I mean, you put a big guy on him and he's going to take him out on the floor and just go by him. And you put a smaller guy on him and come on, he weighs 290 pounds and, he jumps over anything that's in his path. It just makes complete sense that he's going to step right in and be able to be super effective. And just, again, I'm with you 100%, Joe, that I think that he's a can't miss. I mean, barring injury, I just don't see how he doesn't succeed at the highest level. I'll be curious, and I don't know if you, what your thought on this would be, but the trend is right now, obviously we just saw the most recent dunk contest. Guys that are stars don't participate. It's hard to believe that he wouldn't participate in at least one dunk contest in his rookie year. I think it would just be incredible to see what he would pull off.
Yeah, and it's in Chicago next year, so the All-Star game. So trust me, and Zach LaVine won't come out and say it yet, but there's a lot of pressure for him to be in that dunk contest, go back and reclaim what to me was one of the best dunk contests ever between he and Gordon that year, which I think, you know, was better than Jordan and Dominique, which to that time had been the best one. So, I mean, you put Zach in there and Zion, come on. I mean, that's must-see TV. I mean, that would actually make me excited about the dunk contest. So, yeah, and the other thing, too, that you brought up, you know, there's the thought of, well, where's he going to play? Well, the NBA is positionless now. I mean, there's no, you know, there's no the days of he's a power forward, he's a small. No, you know what? There's ball handlers, there's scorers. There's so much versatility, especially with everybody switching now. You have to be versatile. You have to be, you know, Lauri Markkanen, they have him at 4 and 5. You know, Otto Porter, they've had him at 3, 4, and he's guarded some fives. So, I mean, you know, that's just the game right now. And you see with Golden State, that lineup of depth that they put in there at the end. I mean, that's what that lineup's all about, is they're all versatile enough to switch. So I'm not worried about, well, where's he going to play, or he's a tweener, is he a 3 or a 4, or can he be a 5 in a small lineup? You know, you just go out and be a basketball player.
It's hilarious that the term tweener used to be such a, you know, have such negative, it's such a negative connotation. And now basically that's what everybody wants, is a guy who can slide amongst positions. It's incredible.
When I heard tweener, I thought Anthony Bennett. Because that's what we heard. That's the first name that made me think of, because when we drafted him, they were like, oh, he's a tweener, we don't know where he's going to fit. Well, he didn't fit. How about that?
We know where it fits, not in the NBA.
Yeah, right. On a couch. That's where Anthony Bennett unfortunately fits. So that pick did not work out too well. Let's put it mildly. So I definitely think Zion is going to be the number one pick. I wanted to ask you what your thought was in terms of, you know, you mentioned some of the situations with, let's just call it generously, the tanking situation. Do you think that the way that they've smoothed out the odds to get the number one pick, do you think that that's made any difference in terms of how any of these teams at the bottom are approaching, you know, the last few games of the season here? Are they trying less to lose, more to win? What's your take on how that's worked out?
Well, I mean, the big thing is you want to be in that bottom three, because then you all have the same odds up front. Where the difference is where you can slide to. And that's what people don't understand. You know, I so many people send emails to me, or you get these Twitter arguments about people that are, oh, you're making too much of of them winning games and getting upset about it, because the percentage is so small. The difference is 14% to 12.5. If you're out of that top three and you go to that number four spot where the Bulls sit right now. But here's the problem. It's the back end that people don't understand. If you're at 4, you can slip to 8 now. And if you're at 3, you can slip to 7. And if you're at 2, and then your percentages to slip to 6 grow even more. So, I mean, you know, the Tankathon website, they have a great breakdown of exactly what your percentages are, what you can slide to. And that's what I think people get lost. They just look at the 1.5% up front and say, oh, well, it's not a big deal. When you have a draft like this, if it's last year's draft or the draft from 2 years ago that I think probably went 8, 9 deep and you felt comfortable about, yeah, then it's not a big deal. But when it's one guy in Zion Williamson, and then on most draft boards and most scouts I talk to, then you're talking about Barrett and Ja Morant are 2, 3. And then you have a huge, because unless something Cam Reddish does that really excites you, because I don't see it. To me, he's a rotation player right now. He's a guy you're going to draft probably 4th overall and won't have any impact on your starting unit. And to me, that's a problem. I mean, to me, he looks like a rotation guy who's a project to eventually become a starter. So that's why when I look at this draft, you can't just say, well, here's the math. You have to say, how does the math stack up to what the mock draft and what these guys can be? Now, look, there's always going to be a guy who's drafted 9th that should have been top 3 when you do the redraft 2 years later. I mean, you have that with Donovan Mitchell. You have that with, you know, you go through every draft and you could find guys like that. I mean, hell, Draymond Green was a 2nd-round pick. So
Giannis was 15.
Yeah, exactly. So you're going to have that in every draft. But just looking at this draft right now, if you're an NBA team and you match it up with the math, and that's where the debate is. And I think that's why you saw some. So the Bulls go right now, Atlanta's 5. The Bulls are 4 as far as that worst record. And they had a back-to-back against each other last week. So Bulls go into Atlanta, and all of a sudden the guy that lit them up for 35 points, gets the last time they played earlier this year, he gets the flu. So the next night, the Bulls say, well, you know what? Because that game went four overtimes, we're going to worry about load management, as they like to call it. And we're going to sit Otto Porter, who obviously has been, you know, one of their better players. And they were actually also thinking about sitting Chris Dunn, but that was for a different reason. And then Atlanta comes back and wins that game. So I think you had a little jockeying going on there between the two teams, saying, with the Bulls saying, look, you know, we're okay winning games and beating some of the big guys and taking some of the scalps from, you know, the Sixers and teams like that, as long as we feel we're still locked in that four spot. But we're not going to go two wins over you and jeopardize going to that fifth spot. So I think you're seeing that. And then I had a chance to interview Michael Reinsdorf, the president slash owner, on Monday. And I flat out asked him, I mean, what's your kind of philosophy on this? Because I know last year his philosophy was we have to be in that bottom seven because they felt that's where the draft cutoff was. And right now his philosophy is, look, we have what we think is a cornerstone guy in Lauri Markkanen. We have a guy like Zach LaVine, who we may see his ceiling on. I mean, I don't know if there's a ceiling on Lauri yet. I mean, I think there's still a lot of room for improvement, which they're excited about. Zach, I mean, look, Zach can flat out score, but I think we kind of see a ceiling on Zach. But there's two guys that they feel really good about, and they feel like the next step is those guys winning NBA games and winning clutch moments and building that. Now, I'll debate that. I think Trae Young is developing just fine as the season's gone on from the beginning to where he is now. And I don't think he has to win games to show that improvement. I mean, we see it. We see that improvement. Their debate right now is wins are more important than the idea of going after that 1.5.
Do you buy that?
No, because of the way this draft sets up. I think if they would have argued this with me last year, I would have been like, yeah, okay, I get it. Because they got Wendell at 7, and you just go through that draft last year. It was a pretty deep draft through 10, at least on paper, where they said, okay, it's going to go this deep. The draft 2 years ago, even more so. I mean, Lauri Markkanen, they grabbed him 7. And, Dallas had the next pick, and I think they were going to take him at 8. So, that draft went comfortably down to 10 or 11 where teams felt good about it. But this year's draft's different. It's going to dry up quickly. And so I think you have to adjust to what you see as the potential of that draft.
Do you think there is a downside? This is one of the things that I always wonder about is, do you think there's a downside to, again, if you have a young team and you're just losing. And obviously a lot of those young players, I mean, if they've won their whole entire career. And so now you get to the pro level and you come in your rookie year, maybe your second year, and you win 15 to 20 games. Do you think that negatively impacts the long-term future of those players, that they're like, oh, we're in this losing environment, and they don't really learn what it takes to be a professional, what it takes to win? Or do you think that point of view is maybe overblown, and once you get the right players in place, that those guys can quickly rebound and be like, hey, I've been a winning player my whole life. This one or two seasons of not being successful helps us to get a better draft pick. And then we, boom, once we have the guys in place and we're ready to go. What's your take on that situation?
Well, I mean, to me, that falls on the front office to A, know what they have in that locker room as far as the makeup of that guy. I mean, there's a reason that Jabari Parker had to go this year for the Bulls, because they felt he was poisoning Zach LaVine. Zach was becoming a bad leader. Zach was becoming frustrated with the losing, and he was starting to get pissy. And we could all see it in January. Things were starting to spiral, in a bad direction. The coaching change in early December. He didn't. He was probably one of the few that wasn't buying the Jim Boylan boot camp mentality, and he was going the wrong direction. And that's because they didn't have the right vets. You have to have the right vets in an NBA locker room. He doesn't even have to be a starter. He's got to be the right vet. He's got to be that dog that's going to come in and say, look, this is how we're going to do it. This is the way I was brought up doing it. Anybody that's got a problem with me, there's all kind of little nooks and crannies in this arena, and we'll go find them. and you have to have that kind of guy in that locker room. And the Bulls didn't have that. They brought in Jabari Parker.
What's the deal with Jabari?
He's a mope. He's a 265-pound mope. They gave him $20 million to come home, and he shows up out of shape, not giving a damn about anything except Jabari Parker. And his first day on the job, which is the day he signed, to me, that's your first day on the job, goes on local radio and says, I'm not paid to play defense. I'm not paid to play defense. I'm not going to play defense. There's guys in this league that are paid to play defense, and I'm not one of them. And so that was the attitude right away. And, you know, I talked to Fred Hoiberg frequently, and I still touch base with him every so often. And Fred knew once Jabari was signed that his job was in danger, because he had a guy that was not coachable.
Did you have any awareness of Jabari Parker as a high school player in Chicago? Like, what was his reputation? I don't remember him having that type of reputation.
Well, see, the problem was he came from Simeon. And so there's a pedestal there because Derek was from Simeon, and Derek knew him when Jabari was younger. There's some pictures of them, you know, that they took. And so there was a free pass kind of given of excitement when they brought him home, not as much as the front office thought. I think the front office thought, oh, we're bringing this hometown kid home. People are just going to, I mean, the tickets are already sold for Bulls games. I mean, they're second in attendance this year, and as bad as that product's been, because the tickets are sold, but they thought there'd be more butts in the seats as far as people showing up and concession money and all that kind of stuff. And instantly he showed up in a training camp and was what he was, Wendell Jabari. I mean, that's his reputation. He just doesn't. He's a guy that's blessed with things and has gifts, but it's not his passion. And if you're in this game and it's not your passion, that gets exposed. And I think Milwaukee made him the second overall pick, right? And basically he just said, hey, you know what? We're good. You can go do what you want to do. So I think that you know, he had the knee injury, and obviously you feel bad for that, battling back for that. Two of them, you know, actually. So you know, I'm sure that curtailed his career, but at the same time, you just see a guy who's low energy, doesn't inspire, and in a locker room of young guys, it just wasn't working well. So, yeah, I mean, I could see if losing piles up and you don't have the right guys in place, whether it is the young guys that you have that are taking those losses, or you don't have the right vets, yeah, it becomes a real bad product, and it could be a real bad cleanup. I mean, you look at what some teams are going through right now. I mean, what's Washington's exit strategy? You know what I mean? How
yeah,
they going?
I have no idea.
Exactly. They, you know, they dealt Otto Porter to get rid of the $26, $27 million contract and lighten the load, but they're still on the hook for a backcourt where one of them might not play all through of next year. So, I mean, that's a big problem. If you make a major decision like that and it backfires in the NBA, you're trapped for a while. You're trapped in NBA hell.
They can't do anything. I mean, Washington can't do anything with that wall contract. Until that wall contract is gone, I mean, they're basically just they have nothing. I mean, there's nothing they can do.
And that's what the Bulls were fearful of if they committed to Jimmy Butler. Now, I think Jimmy Butler is a whole different thing, and I think Jimmy Butler was willing to recruit and try and build something in Chicago, and I debate this with the Bulls front office often in some of our heated exchanges that, you know, that they I feel they lied to Jimmy, and they were disingenuous in telling him before he went on vacation over to Europe that they're not trading him, and then trading him. And he, you know, he wanted to build something in Chicago. So they just didn't want to commit that 200 and whatever it was, 238, you know, as a max, super max player. So yeah, if you do that, you better have a plan with other guys coming in and your star player recruiting. Otherwise you're in trouble.
So what's with the two guys that obviously they want to build around probably more than anybody, the two young guys and Zach LaVine as well, but Markkanen and Carter, what's your take on those two guys as future, I don't know if you want to call them cornerstone pieces, but as two guys that you can look to build a winning team around? What's your take on their personality and the kind of team you're going to be able to put around them, just as, not necessarily as basketball players, but just as what you've described as locker room guys and guys are going to work hard? Where do they fit into that scheme?
You know, Lowry is a pretty laid back, kind of fits that stereotypical guy from Finland where they don't show a lot of emotion. So you're going to need, you know, he's not going to be the fiery leader if that's what he has. As far as his basketball skill though, and what he did in the month of February, especially, I think he was like 26 points a game and 12.2 rebounds, you know, over that 11 game span. Much more aggressive on the boards. I think he can be, the sky, I think, is still there's not a ceiling yet on him. So I think that's what they're excited about. You know, Wendell, I think they're a little more excited about him than I am. I think he can be very good. The Al Horford comp, I don't think is fair. I don't think we've seen enough of his game. And obviously the thumb injury hurt that development, you know, only getting the 44 games in this year. That kind of stunt the development a little bit. Love his makeup, though. I mean, he's got a great makeup, selfless guy. But they still need that wow player, and that's the thing. You know, Zach, I think, wants to be that. You know, Otto Porter doesn't have a big personality, but is a pro. I mean, that's the one thing you could say about Otto Porter that you didn't see at Washington because of that dominant backcourt. You get to see it here in Chicago that he's really a great leader, great pro. The big thing for the Bulls locker room is now Zach can't say, well, I don't feel like playing defense tonight, or I don't feel like practicing, because you now have a guy that's out there playing defense at a high level in Otto Porter, willing to practice whenever practice is called, and now making more than Zach LaVine. So how, you know, I mean, that's a big deal. You know, money is a big deal in an NBA locker room. And when the guy making the most money is willing to do the dirty work, no one can say anything. That's why the Bulls wanted to make that trade, to get rid themselves of Jabari Parker, but also bring a pro in that Zach could kind of keep an eye on. So, and you know, and so when you talk about those two in Wendell Carter and Laurie, you also have to, because they're locked into Zach and because they're already locked into Otto, it's really that they're looking at it a core four right now. So who's going to be your point guard, I think, is the big debate with the Bulls moving forward. And Chris Dunn showed signs last year and then has really digressed this year. So I think that's where they go shopping. If they don't get lucky and jump up to two or three and draft a Ja Morant, I think that's where they go shopping for a veteran free agent, whether it's Ricky Rubio or Darren Collison or a guy like that, to kind of play make, give them a three-point option, stabilize the locker room a little bit more. So, you know, for year two of the rebuild going into year three, they feel pretty good about it. And they should, but you have to hit. Lowry has to be a superstar. You got it. This is a superstar league. And if not, at some point you've got to sit down and say, okay, where are we going to find the superstar? And that's where the Bulls have failed miserably. And that's the big knock on this front office, is they can't land a superstar.
Yeah. You would think, obviously, with the city of Chicago being, you know, a draw, and I think being in the East should also be a draw, as we see with the LeBron situation. What's the status with Coach Boylan?
You know, his first week was not the best first week.
All right. Well, I like how you're being, you're being generous, Joe.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
I like that.
Well, you know, I will say that, he came on very strong, but for a reason. It was almost a code red. The front office ordered a code red that, hey, you make these guys start understanding that this is about being in shape, being in condition, not backing out of practice, having a loud voice in that locker room, having a loud voice in practice. If you got to go old school Norman Dale and go Hoosiers on him, then do so. And that's what he did. And it rubbed some guys the wrong way. But my point to the whole organization was, okay, so now what you're telling us is you want a hard-ass coach to push guys, but you had that in Tom Thibodeau, who to me is a top five coach, but he was too hard because he wouldn't involve you guys as the front office, which he shouldn't, because that's not your position. So then you go the opposite, which most organizations do. If you have a hard guy, you bring in a guy that you feel is more player friendly. But they bring in Fred. In their eyes, they feel like the players are walking all over Fred. That should have come out in the interview process. Or if you feel that way, when you're talking to Fred, I mean, look, when you're talking to Fred Hoiberg, all you had to do is say, so what was your background in the NBA locker room? And he would say, well, my best experience was my days in Minnesota, where the players ruled the locker room. The coach didn't have to come in. Kevin Garnett was the alpha. Kevin Garnett made us practice until we all felt sore. And then we go practice again. There were no questions asked. So that's the environment he came from. So he gets a head coaching job in the NBA. What do you think his mentality is?
Right. That's what he expects.
Yeah. I'm not going to peek my head in the locker room. These guys got to govern themselves. I've got on my roster Jimmy Butler, Joakim Noah, Pau Gasol, Derrick Rose. Why do I have to peek my head in that locker room? He didn't know that he was inheriting an insane asylum because of how the front office turned Derek and Joakim against Jimmy Butler and Pau Gasol, and he inherited a civil war. So from day one, he never really got a chance. And that's what I'll say about Fred, is he never got a chance. You know, they brought him in for his offense, and they never gave him players that fit his type of offense. They said they were going young, finally, and then all the guys got hurt at the beginning of this year, and before they could even come back, they fired him. So my feelings on Jim are he is aggressive, assertive, asked things to be done the right way. He was assistant under Rudy Tomjanovich. He was assistant under Pop. So accidentally, he had to learn some stuff from those guys, even if, you know, there are a lot of people that aren't big Boylan fans in the city right now. So my whole thing on him is, look, he promised he was going to slow the offense down and make it look bad so these guys learn the basic. And then once they figure that out, he was going to let them run. And he's done just that. Now they're running. They're playing better. He broke the Colts. I mean, that was his job, break the Colts and get them to learn how to be big boy horses. And that's what he's trying to do. So I would say right now he's the right guy for the job. Is he long term? I don't know that. Is he just a stepping stone coach? I don't know that, but I don't think anybody does. But as far as right now, considering the mess that the front office has put the coaching staffs in, the last three coaching staffs, I'd probably say that for right now, he's the right guy for the job.
He'll probably be back next year in your mind?
Well, yeah, because, you know, they're paying. I mean, just look at the money. You know, I covered Jerry Reinsdorf for 12 years when I covered the White Sox. And then I jump over to the Bulls. And the one thing Jerry hates is paying dead money to managers and coaches. And so he's paying another $5 million to Fred next year. They up Jim to $1 million this year from his assistant salary. And then he's $1.6 million with incentives next year. So if they were to step away from him in this summer, you're talking about possibly owing $6.6 million going into next year without a head coach. And then what's your price to get a head coach? I mean, are you paying out another $5 million a year? So now you're paying almost $11-12 million just in coaches. Jerry will not do that. So I definitely think that he'll get that nod going into next year, and we'll evaluate from there.
Understand. All right, let's jump from the Bulls. Let's talk some general NBA goings on and happenings. The announcement came out today that the Lakers are going to put LeBron on a minutes restriction. What's your take on the whole Lakers debacle that's gone on this year? And just give us your general thoughts on that.
Just a complete crap show. I mean, it is what it is. Here's what I'll say. Before LeBron got hurt, you just look at where they were. It's the same argument I made with the Jimmy Butler thing last year. Before Jimmy Butler got hurt, you look at where the Timberwolves were. They were number 3 seed in the West. Before LeBron got hurt, were they number 4 when he got hurt?
Yeah, they were somewhere right in there. Yeah.
So that shows you the impact of him. And I think, you know, I don't think he's right when he got back, but I think he came back frustrated that these young guys couldn't hold down the fort while he was gone. So you're getting a guy that's frustrated. And look, LeBron is at a point in his career where – he dictate. I mean, he's to you know. Forget the whole Jordan LeBron comparisons on the court. Off the court, there is no comparison. Jordan's impact on the league was a shoe. LeBron's impact on the league was player power that has never been seen in any sport. So you can't really compare the two when you want to weigh their legacy. If you want to weigh it, stats and numbers and championships, that's one thing. But if you want to weigh it as far as impact on the game and impact in the league, not even close. LeBron has been the most important fixture in NBA history just because of what he's done as far as empowering players. And now you're seeing it across every sport where these guys are saying, look, you got Bryce Harper coming out and saying, yeah, next year I want Trout. And Major League Baseball saying, whoa, we don't recruit in Major League Baseball.
Yeah, where did that come from all of a sudden?
And Bryce Harper's basically saying, guess what? The NBA's been doing it. It's probably the most entertaining offseason of any sport, what the NBA does. So it's about time baseball starts
doing
it.
365 days a year. You know?
Absolutely.
Like before it would end in the middle of June, and you wouldn't hear anything. Like, you didn't even care about Summer League. Now you're sitting here, who's sitting courtside of the Summer League game? Because that truly matters. You know, it's just crazy.
Absolutely. The Team USA, who's playing for Team USA, who were until this year where the league kind of figured it out. And I think the players kind of got sick of it. The funny thing was, for years, no player of any kind of power or dominance or wanted to be the player rep. And then all of a sudden, all the big name guys start becoming player reps because they figured out during the All-Star break, you get to go to the Bahamas and all get together. That's where you recruit. During the offseason, you all have to get together to talk over player stuff. That's where you recruit. And now you're seeing guys starting to step down from that because the NBA figured it out. And I think the NBA is trying to monitor that a little more. But and that all goes back to one person, LeBron James. So I think once LeBron got back from that injury and kind of saw that, look, this isn't working, and then they couldn't get Anthony Davis, I think that kind of just changed the whole outlook of the season. So, you know, they are what they are right now. I don't think LeBron's 100%. I think he came back probably a little earlier than he wanted, just hoping that his presence alone and his just ability to play make would be enough. It's not. Has he slipped in some aspects of his game? Yeah, I think his defense has slipped. And I don't think it's physical. I just think when he has to carry a team like that, his will only allows so much, and it doesn't allow him to do it both ways anymore. So, it's a total fiasco right now, but it's great print, it's great copy, and it's great TV, and that's what the NBA wants. I don't think anybody in the NBA offices is complaining about the drama and the soap opera that is the Los Angeles Lakers. So I get it that they're going to rest him now. There's no reason to, at his age and the miles, and you know, they could just look statistically where they are. Their chance of making the playoffs are so small. There's no reason to endanger him for the future when they feel like they are one of the teams that can be a big player in things this summer.
What do you think happens? Going into next season, what does their roster look like? You know, next November.
And 1st. How soon after the season does Luke Walton get fired?
Luke Walton gets fired day. Are they at home or away that last game? Because they'll either be fired on the plane flying home or right after the game's over in his office.
No, they issue him a parachute.
They at least let him on the plane and then give him a parachute. Yeah. That'd be immediate, and I think they'll, you know, if Ty Lue ends up there, I don't think anybody'd be surprised, obviously. I think what, you know, everyone's like, well, see, to me, the Lakers aren't in the position to be that domino. The domino is what happens in Boston, because if they feel like Kyrie has no intention to stay, which I don't think he does, because that's a whole altogether strange.
That
dude.
That place is Boston. Yeah.
When you choose Kobe Bryant to be your mentor, you need to look in the mirror and say, what are my life choices? So I have all kind of questions about Kyrie Irving, but I think that's the domino that makes everything fall, is what does Boston do? If Kyrie says I'm staying and they feel like they can dangle that talent out there that they have, I mean, because they have a surplus of talent and could probably make a better trade than anyone else if you're New Orleans. Does New Orleans make that deal? And does Danny Ainge, who is you know, I know Antonio Brown's calling himself Mr. Big Chest, but trust me, Danny Ainge feels like he is the real Mr. Big Chest, and he walks in any room and can convince anybody of anything. So does he feel good enough about going after Anthony Davis and saying, look, you come here and we will make you love Boston. You will sign a long-term deal to stay here because you'll love it so much. So that, to me, that's the first domino, is what happens in Boston. Then the carryover to Los Angeles will be after that, based on what happens in Boston. So I think everything that happens starts with Kyrie in Boston. And I'm just talking about the Anthony Davis thing.
Right. What's your gut on what Kyrie does?
I don't know. He's a weird dude, so I don't know. I don't think anybody does. If you would have said 3 months ago or 4 months ago, I know that he and, you know, I reported this first. This was before anyone broke it. I knew Jimmy Butler wanted out of Minnesota at the end of last season and wrote the whole story. And the Minnesota writers are like, no way. And my whole story was about Jimmy and Kyrie have been plotting about how they can play together for years. So a month before Kyrie demanded that trade, I wrote a story how Jimmy and Kyrie it was right before it was during the summer. It was there were rumors that the Bulls were going to trade Jimmy. Then they were telling Jimmy they weren't. Jimmy was getting all kind of text messages from Cleveland, from Kyrie, from LeBron, from everyone. Hey, push to come to Cleveland. Well, then Griff gets fired. And boom, just like that, Kyrie flips. And because I think he felt like, well, LeBron's not staying now. He flips and he's telling Jimmy, get me to Chicago. So right before Jimmy went on that vacation, I wrote this big story how, you know, Jimmy wants to build the dynasty here. He wants, you know, and the Bulls didn't have the people to get Kyrie, but they could have got a third team involved. And that's what Jimmy wanted. Now, would it have worked out? Who knows? Because the Bulls decided, you know, let's pull the plug. So Jimmy wanted to play with Kyrie 2 years ago. Those two really got along with Team USA. They really liked each other. And so that was the first piece of the puzzle. But now you've got this whole thing with KD and what he wants to do. And now does Kyrie want to go with Kevin Durant? I think that's kind of the unknown. Do those two want to take it to Brooklyn or New York and do something on that Big Apple stage that hasn't been done? And the thing is, both of those guys, there's three guys in the NBA that no one has a pulse of because they're just kind of trippy, weird dudes. It's Kevin Durant, Kyrie, and Kawhi Leonard are just three guys that you just have no – I mean, they don't have big entourages. They don't have – you know, there's not back channels. There's not things leaking. They have some friends in the league, obviously, with Kyrie and Jimmy Butler were being are friends. But it's just hard for stuff to – say this is what for sure they're going to do, because I think they don't even know what they're going to do half the time. So
do you feel there's any chance he goes to Lakers?
No. I think that whole phone call thing was overblown. I think he, wherever he goes, he wants to be, it's important for him to be the face. That's why the Jimmy Butler thing matches up better, because Jimmy doesn't need to be the face. Jimmy doesn't need to put up 30 a night. You know, if Jimmy puts up 15, 7, and 8, and has a couple steals, he feels like it's a great game, and they get the win. So that's what he's about. I think it's important for Kyrie to feel he's the face, he is the it, and I don't think he's getting that in Boston. I think that's part of the problem. So, you know, I think
can he and KD, can they really go to New York and play under James Dolan? I mean, I know the attraction of New York City, and I get that, you know, if you go there and you revive the Knicks, but there's such a bad track record of bad basketball and poor decision making, and just
right.
can you really foresee a scenario where they go to New York and under the tutelage of James Dolan? I just don't see that when they start really looking at it.
Yeah, because here's the James Dolan's not going to be on the court, and you have to look at the ego of Kevin Durant and what he's chasing. His whole thing, ever since LeBron beat him that first time when Miami won that title, he's been chasing, okay? And, I mean, think about what he's done to earn a ring. You had that team down, and you couldn't finish it, and so you joined them the next year? I mean, just to beat LeBron? And now that you've beat him and you've slain that dragon, you're still not getting the respect that you think you should get. Because everyone's saying, well, you're playing with Steph and you're playing with Clay and you're playing with, and now you can't even commit to those guys in your own locker room. And that's what, you know, Draymond Green is the realest dude in this league. Trust me. And when he calls you out and says, dude, you can't commit to us, and I'm going to call you on that and call BS on you all year. That tells you what kind of person Kevin Durant is. That what is he chasing? So do you think it's for a guy to have that mentality of I'm going to join the team that just eliminated me, even though I had them down, so I could finally win that first ring, and then he's still not getting it. So then he says, I got to go bigger. What's the biggest place I can go? The Mecca, the NBA's Mecca, and win there, and then no one can doubt my legacy. I'm the best. And I think that's how Kevin Durant thinks. And so I don't think James Dolan or the curse or all that stuff weighs in his head. I think he thinks, what do I have to do so people finally understand my greatness? And it's go and win in New York on the biggest stage in the NBA.
Yeah, I mean, I don't understand the mentality of leaving and going and joining your you know, the team that that just beat you. To me, that just I didn't understand at the time. I continue not to understand it from a player perspective.
Right, right.
It just doesn't make any sense. I mean, I get the positives. I get what he thought he was going to get out of it. But just as a competitive person, I don't see how you battle guys to that level and then all of a sudden you're like, all right, I'm going to come play with you guys. It just doesn't make sense to me.
It's like when Ray Allen went to the Heat.
There you go.
Registration is now open at www.headstartbasketball.com for this summer's Head Start Basketball Camps. We'll be hosting camps this summer in Strongsville, Westlake, Avon Lake, Oberlin, Brunswick, Highland Heights, Mentor, and Hudson. At Head Start Basketball, we care deeply about making a positive impact on the lives of young basketball players, both on and off the court. It's through building strong relationships with our players, parents, and coaching staff that we are able to use the game of basketball to enrich the lives of those we interact with, both inside and outside of our organization. We believe that our attention to detail, our growth mindset, and our commitment to lifelong learning allows us to help our players achieve their fullest potential. We are passionately committed to providing players, parents, and coaches with everything they need to reach their goals. These core values run through everything we do. Check out our website, www.headstartbasketball.com, and discover why you should attend a Head Start Basketball Camp this summer. Hope to see you there.
Here's the one thing I learned right away when I started covering the White Sox way back in the day. You know, you have this, you know, I covered Ohio State for 2.5 years, so I had that kind of college mentality where everything's just kind of rah rah for the team. No one's bigger than the team. No one's bigger than the colors. No one's bigger than the emblem on the helmet, whatever sport it was. My first spring training covering the White Sox, the first thing that struck me was how petty these guys are. And I'm not talking about rings. We're not even talking about rings. We're talking about, so say the Nike guy comes, okay? And he goes around to the Nike guys, the big Nike guys that really he cares about, because they may all be wearing Nike, but just because you're wearing Nike, the Nike rep doesn't care about you because you're not doing anything for Nike except wearing your shoe. You're their gamble. But they put these care packages together. Hey, we got you some new stuff. It's not even on the market yet. Nike batting glove. Hey, try out this Nike glove. You can't even use it during games because it's against Major League Baseball, but try it out. Just tell us what we think. And the first thing you do is you watch the eyes of all the other players in the locker room or the clubhouse, and they're like, I want that. Whether it's a piece of jewelry or a new batting glove, I want that. Why aren't I getting that? So that's the first thing you start seeing on that professional level is just how petty these guys are. And now take it to the level that Kevin Durant is at and LeBron is at and these legacy guys. And just think about how that pettiness is now magnified, where Kevin Durant had to make a burner account on Twitter, okay, just to try to get in arguments for people and clean up his name.
Yeah, how ridiculous is that? I mean, when you really stop and think about that whole situation, it's totally ridiculous that a professional athlete even cares to engage with fans in that kind of dialogue, and two, that, I mean, don't you have anything better to do with your time?
Well, that's the problem. They have a lot of free time. And that's secondly, true. But that's my point of just how petty and how thin-skinned some of these guys are. And so you can't say Kevin Durant is, if he actually was thinking about it logically like we would, step back and say, well, anything Dolan touches turns to crud. So I'm going to stay away from that. And I'm just going to stay in my Golden State situation and collect rings. That's what the logical person would say. But when you get to that level they're at, where they're looking for something that we can't, as normal thinking people, can't put our hand around and grasp, where they're chasing some kind of legacy and some kind of stamp in NBA history that no one else can touch, New York's the perfect place for him. And that's why I don't think you could discount it, because if you do, you're just thinking logically. If you're thinking like Kevin Durant or try to put your feet in Kevin Durant's shoes, then you start to understand that anything this guy decides is possible. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Got it. So let's think about this season and talk Golden State a little bit. Do you think there's any way that they get beat, barring an injury. If they're healthy going into, let's say, the Western Conference Finals, is there any way that they can – is there anybody that can beat them in the West or whoever comes out of the East?
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, Houston had them where we all know they had them before Chris Paul got injured, and that's the fun storyline right now is can Houston do that to them? And I don't think they can. I think Golden State's one of those dynasty teams that knows how to flip the switch and when to flip the switch. So that's why I think it's funny how you could turn on, First Take or whatever you turn on in the morning and get yelled at by Stephen A. And every day it's the same thing. The Lakers, Golden State's in trouble. You know, it's the same topics over and over. There's one thing about Golden State and the greatness of that team. They have shown that they are a different team when it matters. So, no, I think they're the favorite. I don't think there's a team in the East that beats them. Houston, it'll be interesting, but I think at the end Golden State will win. NBA games are kind of like boxing matches where it's you know, the two boxers, it's all about the makeup of the boxers. And, you know, Philadelphia can't beat Boston because it's a bad matchup. It's just schematically a bad matchup. So that's a team they want to probably avoid in that first round and make sure that they don't line up 4 and 5. So, you know, Houston matches up well with what Golden State wants to do. But I don't think until you knock the champ out in 7 games, I'll have to see it. And I don't think there's any team that's going to.
What's your take on James Harden?
In his play or as a person?
Yeah, his play. Like I've said it numerous times on the show. Harden, I mean, he's been fantastic this year. And obviously he's averaging 36 points a game. But I still come back to he's had multiple opportunities over the years in big games to come through and carry his team. And he always seems to come up small. Yeah. And so when I look at Houston, and even if you look at that series last year, you know, Golden State was beatable in game 7 last year.
Yeah.
And they were beatable. If James Harden is, you know, one of the top 2-3 players and he's a legacy guy, like you mentioned earlier, if he's one of those guys, when you have an opponent on the ropes like that, you figure out a way to get it done. And I just haven't seen him get it done. And so that's why I'm dubious of Houston's chances, simply because I just don't think Harden in big moments is the guy that I want. He's not the guy I want leading my team in big moments. And that's why I always have doubt in terms of what I think Houston can be.
Mike's not a big fan.
No, here's what I'll say about, you know, guys that I think great players can learn to finish off teams and learn to be that clutch guy. You know, I think LeBron learned it. You know, I think LeBron is shown that he can, you know, developed into a clutch guy. But I see what you're saying about James Harden. Look, fantastic scorer, probably gets as many calls as any player I've seen since back when Adrian Dantley was playing. I mean, you flinch and you're anywhere near James Harden. The things he gets away with his dribble are just, I mean, hilarious. So, I mean, there's definitely some things that he does that I appreciate. Can he win it all? Yes, but I think a lot of things around him have to go well, you know. And I could see him delivering in a clutch game just because he hasn't done it yet. I think when you're that great of a scorer, you know, I don't get into this whole thing of that you once you if you're not clutch, you can never be clutch. I think that's a skill that could be learned, where you just become more fearless. You don't worry about your shot falling or not falling or get caught up when it's not falling in a key moment. And I think that's all a learned trait. It's a learned muscle memory. So, you know, I won't say that he can't do it, but I just think he's going against, you know, arguably one of the greatest teams I've ever seen. So, you know, is he a player that we're always going to remember that has kind of imprinted himself on the NBA map? I'd say, yeah, or if not, he's on that fringe. I think that's how good he is from a scoring standpoint. And I'm anxious to see exactly what he does this year and next year, because I think the window probably closes after that.
Yeah. I think this year it's, you know, this is the year. I mean, I think he's taken a step up even from where he was last year, obviously as a regular season MVP. So if there's ever an opportunity for him to, you know, put the Rockets on his back and demonstrate that he's learned how to be clutch.
As long as he doesn't shoot 1 of 17 from behind the 3-point line.
You want to be a little better than that. Yeah.
You might want to knock down 2 at some point.
Yeah.
But I just don't I have a hard time. I have a hard time buying into him as as a playoff, as a guy who in the playoffs, I'm going to just, he's going to carry me in a game where I need him to carry me. And he hasn't demonstrated that yet. And I think to your point about LeBron definitely grew in that area for sure. I told people all the time that one of the things that I always use to differentiate, you know, watching Michael Jordan versus watching LeBron was when I watched Jordan, I always felt like, you know, they could be down, they could be winning, whatever, that Jordan was going to find a way. And I never doubted that. And that's not to say that he always won every single time, because obviously he didn't. But watching, I always felt like I had that confidence. And with LeBron, I never really got to that point until really last year in that Pacers series and then on through the rest of the Eastern Conference Finals. And then even into game one, you know, of that performance that he had in game one against the Warriors. That was as good as he's ever been from just orchestrating the game and understanding and making big shots and doing all those things. And I really felt like he had turned a corner that I hadn't seen him do before. And so again, Harden could do that this year, but he just hasn't to this point. And so that's where my doubts come in.
No, I mean, and rightfully so, until a player does show it. And, you know, look, that's the big, living here in Chicago and being from Cleveland, and you go back and forth with so many Bulls fans, and the whole Michael LeBron argument to me is pretty funny, because I you know, everyone's like, oh, well, six rings, six chances, never lost a finals, you can't hold a match to him. And the counter to that, which people in Chicago love to forget, is, bruh, when you walked away from the game, your team won 54 games and made it to the Eastern Conference Finals. They were okay without you. When LeBron walked away from Cleveland?
Twice?
What did Cleveland become?
Dumpster fire.
When he walked away from Miami, where's Miami been?
Dumpster fire.
So, yeah, no, I hear you.
So to me, that's, you can't compare the player, because they're two different players. They're two different type of players, so I don't get into the stat of it. But if you're starting a team, if I'm starting a team from scratch and I have to pick either Michael Jordan or LeBron James, I'm going to pick LeBron James every day that ends in Y, because I know he's going to make everybody around him better at the end of the day. So whoever else I get after him is going to be inherently better because of that man that I took first. You take that with Jordan, Jordan got better. But who did Jordan make better?
Mike's gonna say something here.
I'm dumbfounded. I'm dumbfounded. To me it still comes down to, I guess I define greatness by, if I had to win a game, which guy would I want on my side?
Do I have to win the shot or do I have to win the game? There's a difference to me.
I gotta win the game. I mean, Jordan for the entirety of his career played both ends of the floor. And I think LeBron,
not fat Jordan in Washington, he didn't. But
well,
right.
Okay. All right. Yeah. But I don't even discount, Mike
forgets that part of it.
I discount that part of his career. I choose not to acknowledge it. I'm saying even in the best years of LeBron, there were times where he was in pout mode. He was in send a message to front office mode, where he kind of shut it down. And I get where, what he's trying to agitate for in those cases. But I just think that, to me, Jordan was going to do whatever it took to be able to win. And again, I understand he didn't win every year. I understand that he making six finals and winning six finals, that's great. And I understand the argument that there were years where he didn't get there, where LeBron dragged an inferior roster for the finals.
Let me ask you this, Mike. Do you think the Boobie Gibson team, do you think Jordan could have got that team to the finals?
I mean, I have a hard time saying no, just because, again, it's hard to project one guy into the other. I just know that Jordan's will to win. We've had this discussion, Jason and I have had this discussion on the podcast.
You guys could do this every podcast.
Oh, probably. We absolutely could. But Jason and I have talked about, like, you know, Jordan has, you know, I always find a way to, I'm not a big fan of LeBron's style of leadership, where when things aren't going well, you kind of pout, and that's how you demonstrate to whoever, whether it's coaching staff, front office,
other players. That's kind of a newer thing for me.
No, it is. I agree. But, you know, by the same token, you can make the argument that Jordan's style of leadership wasn't for everybody either.
He punched teammates in the face that were much smaller than him. You never seen him punch Charles Oakley. He didn't punch Charles Oakley.
Right. I get it. And so that style of, you know, leadership wasn't for everybody. For me, it comes down to what I said earlier, which is it's just a feeling of if I had to win a game, what guy in the history of basketball that I've watched would I be most convinced that if that guy's on my team, we're going to figure out a way to win that game. And to me, Jordan was that guy. And that goes to, again, both ends of the floor, offensively, defensively, whatever. I just think that he, more than anybody else, what sets him apart is not the physical tools. It's not all the things that he could do. It's just the fact that the will and desire that he had is what sets him apart for me. And I get all the LeBron arguments. And, you know, obviously I've been a fan of LeBron his whole career and being in Cleveland. But I just, to me, Jordan stands above.
I'll answer your question since Mike didn't answer it. The answer of will Jordan take the Boobie Gibson roster to the finals? The answer is no.
No, I don't think he would have either, because and how I prefaced it, I said if I had to start a team, I would take LeBron over Jordan. If I have to have a last shot in a clutch moment, I would take Jordan over LeBron. I would take Kobe over LeBron.
Yeah, there's a lot of guys I'd take over LeBron in that case.
I would take Ray Allen over LeBron.
Well, that's where you get into the difference of their style of play. I mean, LeBron, you know, people would complain, well, why didn't he take that shot? He passed it off. Well, half the time that I saw him pass it off that he was criticized, it was the right basketball play.
Oh, no question about that. There's no doubt.
So, and I get what you're saying.
It was Jeff McGinnis, right?
Yes. And I get what you're saying where Jordan, his mentality was there is no one else taking this shot. No one else taking the shot but me. And that's the big difference in him. But I take it back to if I'm starting a team at the beginning of a season – and I don't know the players that I'm getting after those two, who would I take? I would take LeBron because I think he makes everyone around him better, more so than Jordan does.
Fair enough.
That's my point.
Mike's going to say agree to disagree.
Fair enough. You're never. Hey, that's what makes sports fun, man.
Absolutely. You can barbershop that conversation.
No doubt about that. What's your MVP vote right now? Do you have an MVP vote?
They haven't announced who's got what. I had MVP two of the last 3 years. So
you can't officially talk about it. If you have a vote, is that how it works?
Well, I mean, I can talk about guys. First, I always vote LeBron one or two.
Okay.
And I have a vote because I just, the impact he has is ridiculous. This year, it'd be kind of hard to do just because he did miss so many games. But the other argument is, look, they were a 4 seed in the West before he got hurt, and then look how bad they were without him. So
you could make your point that you made about, you know, he left the Cavs and they're a dumpster fire. So.
Right. So, but just looking at it right now, I think it's real hard to dismiss what James Harden did when all those injuries happened, and he still kept that thing afloat and helped turn that thing around and kind of have them on that beeline now to be that team that's going to be opposite Golden State in the bracket. So I think logically right now, James Harden probably has to get the nod.
How close is Giannis?
Super close. I mean, you're talking inches, but at the same time, Giannis hasn't had to deal with multiple injuries around him. And also Giannis is playing in the East, which I think has gotten way better after the trade deadline. And to me, the East, the battle of between the top four teams in the East is going to be must-watch TV. But I think James Harden's had to deal with more, overcome more, and keep that thing afloat more than Giannis. But, yeah, it's close, and to me it's not over yet. I still have to see closing statements here in the last 16, 17 games, which everyone's playing.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting, especially if Milwaukee gets to 63, 64 wins. I think that's the case for Giannis. Is, you know, hey, we might end up with the best record in the league, and I'm the best player on the best team, or at least the team with the best record. It'll be interesting. I think it's going to be a very, very close vote between those two guys. We'll see how it eventually plays out. You just mentioned the East. Of those teams at the top of the East, which one do you like the most?
Probably Milwaukee right now, just because of their land. strength in their defense and their coach. I love their coach. Don't know what Atlanta was thinking. I thought he should have been treated like Brett Brown was treated in Philadelphia to kind of ride the wave of the storm, even when things are going bad, and because you just trust of how good of a coach he is. And they didn't want to do that. And also, he had some disagreements with the front office, and, you know, it still shows you that the front office wants to run things like they want to run things, even in the NBA. You know, I could see Boston getting hot and getting through it. So that's why I said it's going to be must-see TV. And don't discount Toronto. I thought they did some sneaky moves at the trade deadline and changed the look of their team. And I think Kawhi Leonard is a special, special player that people love to forget about just because of – look, he's a weird dude. I've had to interview that dude, and he's as strange a guy as – a big name guy to interview just because he's so shy and just not.
Did he laugh at all during your interview?
No, I didn't get to hear. I don't think anybody got to hear that strange, creepy laugh until this year. So, you know, and I was asking him, like, you know, he and Tony Snell used to play for the Bulls. Now he's in Milwaukee. They were high school teammates. So, you know, that was the logical. I was covering the finals a couple of years ago, the Spurs Miami finals, the second one. And, you know, no one was around him. And then I figured out why no one was around him, including the Spurs writers, because he was an awful interview. So I just started talking about Tony Snell, which I thought he'd be like, yeah, you know, I have some high school stories. Nothing. You would have thought those two never played together in high school. So, I mean, right there kind of showed me, yeah, this dude. So I did a story on him talking to everybody else about how he hates to talk. That was one of the stories I did in the podcast. you can't discount what he's capable of in the playoffs. I think people forget, not only because he sat out last year and also now that he's in Toronto, which we seem to overlook Toronto just because they're not in the country. I think we forget how good he is, especially come playoff time where, you know, you're putting in 36, 38 minutes and the rotation is shorter and you're getting to see guys and it's a, you know, the same teams going at each other where you can make adjustments and you could put him on anybody to stop what they're doing. So that's going to be interesting to see is don't discount Toronto.
Yeah. I worry about Lowry. I'm not a big Lowry fan for the same reason. I'm not a fan of Harden.
Yeah. Now that's a guy that I look and say he definitely turtles come big moments. I'm not as strong on the Harden thing as you are, but I'll definitely say Kyle Lowry is a guy that turtles when it's time to be a big boy player.
There's just times that he's so apathetic. It's like you're definitely the second best player on your team right now. He just looks like he's kind of just going about floating around out there, not like caring. And we obviously saw it up close and personal with LeBron, like them in the Eastern Conference with the playoffs against LeBron and all that. It was like he was a turtle and he cowered in his shell.
They saw LeBron and they decided to bow before LeBron. That's what that series reminded me of, a team that just decides to bow before the king. And obviously they had to rethink where their organization was going, and I think that's why they saw that opportunity to go after Kawhi, and whether it's a 1-year rental or try persuading him to stay, they felt like something major had to shake up. And there weren't many people talking, you know, you had to give up DeRozan because not many people wanted Lowry. So, it'd be interesting to see if Kawhi's presence could help kind of sturdy Lowry come playoff time and give him a little more confidence to not just be that regular season guy. So, you know, again, all kind of storylines once the Eastern Conference playoffs start.
Yeah, the East is going to be fun because I think all those teams to some degree are a little bit unknown what their ceiling is.
Right.
You know, Philly's trying to put it together. Milwaukee's never really been there. You know, they've been in the first round. Boston, you know, obviously are reincorporating Kyrie and Hayward from last year's playoff run, and you know, Kawhi and Toronto. It's just all those teams are kind of a mystery.
We still haven't mentioned the Pacers, who somehow are floating.
I'll tell you what, we were just there the other night. The Bulls played there the other night, and you know, Oladipo, as soon as he goes down, you're thinking, oh, tragic, that's going to be the end of their season, that's a wrap. And then you actually start watching these dudes, and look, they play as hard as any team I've seen in the last couple months on both ends of the floor. You know, I think that's why the Bulls are looking at Darren Collison. They just love his leadership, his grit, the way he kind of just carries a team and knows when to score, knows the moments, just has that feel of the game. I was impressed with just how hard they play, because the Bulls have actually been playing some pretty good basketball. And, you know, it was close, and the Bulls actually took the lead with about 8 minutes left. And then Indiana did what a good team does and what the number three seeded team does right now, and just said, okay, play time's over, and just went to work. And I don't think they're going to hold that number three spot. I think Philly right now is a game or a half game behind that. I don't think Indiana's going to finish four or finish three. I think Philly's going to jump up there as long as Embiid gets healthy. So, which is good, because I would rather see if Boston and Philly are playing. I don't want to see it round one.
Mike and I were talking about this the other night. I'd love to see that in the first round.
I mean, the drama, the ramification, potential of that series.
Someone's fan base is going to have the ass. I will say that someone's fan base is going to be very disappointed after round one if that goes down as that first round.
Could you imagine the ratings of the first round of NBA Eastern Conference? I think it would be probably the best ratings ever. Philly, Boston in the first round.
Oh, it'd be huge.
I just don't think there's anything that would even be comparable to it.
And can Joel Embiid get Al Horford out of his head? Because, you know, trash as Embiid likes to talk, there's one guy that's his uncle right now, and he can't say anything to.
Absolutely. No question about that. All right, hey, Joe, let's wrap it up by – I want to ask you about one more – topic, and that is some of the rookies that are in the league this year. What's your take on Bagley and Trae Young and Luka and some of these guys that who do you think long term projects to be the best, or what are your take on some of those guys?
Well, I was completely wrong. I wrote a whole column just ripping when the Bulls brought in Trae Young for a workout, pre-draft workout, just ripping them that there's no way they could draft this guy. He's Jimmer Fredette all over again. Don't take him. He's a great playmaker, but that's all he does. He's too small. And all I've had to do is eat those words. So
Did Freezing Cold Takes retweet any of that?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if they have or not, but it was look, I'm not one of the, trust me, as far as writers go, I wrote a big column at the beginning this year apologizing for how cruel and bad I've been bashing Derrick Rose for years. And that he finally got it.
His turnaround's been amazing this year.
It's been amazing. He's kind of slowed down lately.
He's got to win comeback player of the year, right?
Yeah. I would say he's definitely up there. And look, my whole knock on him for years was that simply he did nothing to adjust his game. He was a low IQ player who did nothing to adjust his game. And once that – I mean, as far as God-given athleticism in a point guard, I haven't seen – up close anything like that, what he was doing. And when that's stripped away, the essence of what you are has to come out, and it did in all the wrong ways. And so that was my rip on him, is he never tried to improve his game. And finally he admitted this offseason he had to work on his three-point shot. It was a flat shot, he had to work on it, he fixed it. And so was I apologizing for how wrong I was that he would ever figure it out? Yes. But my whole thing was, I never thought he'd figure it out, and I'm glad he finally did. So getting back to the rookies, Trae Young has maybe eat my words, especially this last month. I think he's been phenomenal. I thought early on when he did have decent games, it was because he was playing for Atlanta. But now I actually see how he works with Collins, how he works with the other guys, his playmaking, his court vision, tremendous, and they do a great job covering him up on defense. He's actually not a bad team defensive player. You know, if he gets switched on certain guys, it's
right. Yeah, he's not going to be able to do anything. But he's an elite passer at this point. I mean,
his vision and his playmaking are top five as far as point guards already. And then if he's going to hit that three consistently, and it's not, and it's done at the right time, and it's not early in the clock when you need a, you know, I mean, there were just some dumb things he was doing the first half of the season that he's made the adjustment to. Luka Doncic, I mean, nothing but plus, plus, plus in every box. You can check every box for him. I think he is the next big thing in the West. Let's see, who else did I Jackson I liked. I like Bagley. I think they're both doing what I thought they would do. Mo Bamba, he was a project. You knew he was a project, and he's turned out to be a project. I wouldn't call him a bust. I think that's way too unfair and too early.
Yeah, hard to know with him being hurt.
You know, obviously.
What about Ayton? What's your take on Ayton?
Sometimes I watch him. You know, look, the big knock on him is there were times he disappeared in college. And especially that first half of the season, you're saying, oh, my God, look at this specimen. And then it never does anything. And then I think finally in the Pac-12 tournament, he got it. And you got all excited and you're like, okay, this monster is just going to be unleashed in the NCAA tournament. And then just a big just fart and just awful. And now you're like, really? That's going to be the number one pick? But I will say this. The spacing of the game helps him. You're seeing him be able to do things more, and you knew he was going to rebound. You knew he was going to – I thought he'd be a better shot blocker at the NBA level than he was in college. Signs. But, look, rookie of the year, it's a two-boat race right now. I think Luka probably has the nod over Trae Young. But I'd say the guy that surprised me the most and the guy I was wrong on was Trae Young. I think Wendell Carter Jr. was in the discussion early on because he did have some moments. But once he got hurt and only had that 44 game on his resume, I think that goes ahead and cancels that out. And, you know, they're excited about him. They have a good feeling about him moving forward. So good rookie class overall. I think it's very comparable to rookie class 2 years ago, the Donovan Mitchell, Jason Tatum, Lowry Markkanen class. I think if they redrafted that, those would be the top three picks out of that draft. So, and that was a deeper draft as well. So I think it's very comparable as far as we're seeing the guys that come out of it. Good rookie class. And I think, like I said, Luka Doncic and Trae Young are kind of headlining. Yeah, I did stories on Luka Doncic last year, the Euro guys at the time. We had a couple of Euro guys, including Nikola Mirotic on the team. And these guys were just raving and just saying, anyone that's knocking that this kid's game won't translate to the NBA is out of their mind. And so I kind of felt, just talking to those guys, that this was coming, this Euro takeover was coming from him. And I think he's lived up to everything.
Yeah, he's proven that to be true. I mean, I think there's no doubt that he's going to be very, very good for a long time. But it'll be interesting to see when Porzingis comes back, what the two of them look like and what else Dallas can do around them to build their team. That'll be an interesting, piece of what's going to happen this summer for sure. All right, well, Joe, hey, we want to be respectful of your time. We've been going about an hour.
No, dude, 15 minutes. It was fun, man. We didn't even get to cleansing Kent State days when I got to cover that.
All right. Well, look, spend 2 minutes, man. Talk. We're here, man. We're not going anywhere.
Cleansing was a terrible interview. No, I'm kidding. No, anyway, look. I mean, look. How many times? I covered you 1 year or two? I don't even remember. I think I covered you for the Kent State paper, what, 1 year or 2 year? I don't even remember how many years I covered you. Do you remember?
Probably two, I would guess. I think two, but I could be wrong.
No, and those were fun teams to cover. Those Kent State teams were fun. You guys made it to the wasn't 1 year you guys made it to the NIT?
We went to the NIT twice. So my freshman year and my sophomore year we made the NIT. So that was fun.
Yeah, that was
fun. That was a good time. We played Michigan State 1 year with Steve Smith and played St. Louis, who had Anthony Bonner and Melvin Robinson.
Yeah, that's right. In St. Louis, right?
Yep. Yeah, yep. Exactly. Yep.
Yeah, I remember that game. Yeah, yeah. No, it was I'm a little older than – I feel like I'm a lot older than Mike, but I'm a couple years older than Mike. So, you know, you kept hearing the stories about once I was out of Strongsville, this is the next it kid. This is the next it kid. And then I actually said, all right, let me go watch this kid. And Clint's good ball. And Clint's, he showed it at the high school level and obviously at the college level. And it was a joy kind of watching him be this person that everyone talked about as the upcoming it kid to be the college player he was. So
yeah, it was a lot of fun, man. It was a lot of fun. I had a great experience at Kent. I've said it a couple times here on the show that, getting an opportunity to play college basketball, you didn't know coming out of high school, I wasn't really highly recruited. And, I had a lot of confidence in myself that I could be able to play at the Division I level if I was given an opportunity. And thankfully, Coach McDonald at Kent gave me that opportunity and I was able to make the most of it. And I always feel like, I had an opportunity to maximize the ability that I was given and have a great college career, get a good education. And, it was just, it was a good time. I enjoyed my time there and, wouldn't trade that for anything, for sure.
I, I remember Clint came and watched one of our intramural games and said that I set the game back. Like, remember that? I got thrown out of the game. <do. laughs> Clint was like, dude, that was probably – I think basketball has been sent back about 20 years after watching that game. That was my highlight in intramural basketball.
That'll happen to the bit. Well, here's what I remember about Kent intramural basketball. You'll appreciate this, Joe. So I think it was my freshman year when I got there, and Billy Toole, who played at Kent, was our graduate assistant. And him and I forget, there was maybe a couple other guys that had played previously that were still hanging around campus, and their intramural team was named At Will, which I thought was my favorite. That's my favorite intramural basketball team name of all time, At Will. I love that name. So
I remember going and watching. I mean, people would go to watch them play the intramural game.
Yeah, I believe it. I believe it.
Because they were, I mean, there were big name guys, and there's so many, and they were so good. So yeah, it was. And you know what? Here's the other thing. Forget the LeBron Jordan debate. The big debate that still goes on is who is better, Tucker Neal or Mike Lindsey?
Ah! Oh no!
I don't want to get into that. Debate too heavily, but
big debate that goes on.
So maybe I have to use the counter argument to the LeBron Michael Jordan debate, and you know, maybe if you, well, I shouldn't say that.
No, say it.
All right, you want me, Joe,
to start a team or take the last shot?
Both. I'll send you the video of my Brunswick shot, the last shot of my career at Strongsville High from about, I don't know, 35, game winner at the buzzer, nothing but net. Do you remember Pat Musa?
No.
Pat Musa, athletic custodian. He's standing in the background when the shot goes in, and he drops his broom when the ball goes. When my final shot goes in the basket. So
that's outstanding.
I think you got to pick me, but you know, I'm biased. So
I got you. I'll go with you.
It's been a lot of fun. We can't see some of the stuff that you're putting out there.
I appreciate it. It's if you want to follow me on Twitter, it's suntimes_hoops. And then email is jcowley@suntimes.com. And that's all on all my story tags on, you know, chicagosuntimes.com. So I'm under all the Bulls coverage and, you know, keeping busy throughout the off season too, writing Bulls stuff. So that's the beat. And I do it year round. This is the seventh or eighth year of doing the NBA. I did the White Sox for 12 years, and then did a column for a couple of years, and now I'm doing the NBA. So, you know, all is well. Still one of those old newspaper guys just trying to get it done. So
there you go. We appreciate it. Well, Joe, we can't thank you enough for jumping on with us tonight. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Head Start Basketball's Player Development Academy offers Cleveland-area players a unique opportunity to improve their basketball skills. Regardless of a player's age, skill level, or position, training with Head Start Basketball will elevate your game to the next level. Do you want to improve your ball handling, become a better shooter, or develop into a more skilled, confident player? Our Academy classes offer training that's designed to do just that. Our training sessions are innovative and will have you learning skills that are transferable to actual games. We have 4 different class skill levels for boys and girls, ages 4 and up. All Player Development Academy classes will be held at the Strongsville Recreation Center. For more information or to get registered, please visit www.headstartbasketball.com.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.